You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on our summer music series set list, we'll feature the Appleton band Dusk. They stop by to perform a set of songs at our studio and talk about their transition from classical music training to playing in a group inspired by soul and old-time country music.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. On Monday, a story published in the Capital Times revealed allegations of neglect and unsanitary conditions at the Wisconsin Veterans Home at King. Governor Scott Walker and lawmakers from both parties are now calling for investigations into that facility.
Robert Menser joins us now, as he does every Friday, to look at this and other top news from the last week here in Wisconsin. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's look at this story of the Wisconsin Veterans Home. We talked about it some with the reporter of the story on Monday, but sum up, what are people saying about this Veterans Home in King?
Yes, so the Cap Times story looked at a number of allegations of mismanagement and just sort of bad conditions at King. So there are photos that they published showing a kind of a red-brown stain in one of the tubs where residents were bathed. There have been some photos that came out just this week after the report was published showing gross yellow water in a sink and tub there, and it looks bad, and it also raises concern about lead content or other pollutants. There are allegations of understaffing or just mismanagement within the institution. And then maybe one of the most interesting or explosive facts in the story is the fact that from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, King in recent years has been running a surplus of between $30 million and $40 million over its two-year budget cycles. And so that surplus has been, in large part, it was shown in the story, has been directed back to the State Department of Veterans Affairs, going for any number of things, salaries of top leaders and other functions of that department, at the same time that residents are pointing out these sort of bad conditions in the facility itself.
And the head of the Veteran Affairs Department in Wisconsin and others have defended the facility, saying, hey, we're getting good ratings from national agencies. Can you talk a little bit about that response?
Right. It is, in fact, a five-star facility. It has gotten good ratings, and rating systems for nursing home facilities. Nursing homes are very highly regulated, and there are a lot of things that are checked and things that they can get dinged on. On the other hand, the checks don't happen all the time, and it's certainly not uncommon to hear of complaints within a facility that may have had decent ratings. The Veterans Affairs Chief John Skokos had been asked by Democrats, including Senator Julie Loss of Stevens Point, about these audit numbers and looking at these budget issues. And at that time, last October, he said that the allegations were wrong and unhelpful. And now, following the publication of this report, the Republicans are on board and the audit committee is on board, and there will be an audit of these numbers to see whether King should have been spending more money on facilities rather than transferring it back to Madison.
And there seems to be, now that, as you say, this report is out, there seems to be bipartisan support in the legislature and Governor Walker, for that matter, for a state investigation. As I understand it, some, especially Democratic lawmakers, are hoping for some federal review as well.
Yeah. I think that there's an argument out there. Certainly, it's one the Democratic legislators have put forward, that it's something of a piece with what we've seen in Lincoln Hills, the juvenile corrections facility in Lincoln County. That they would say it's mismanagement, and they would say that it's the result of budget decisions to not prioritize the management of these facilities. I don't know. Is there a criminal side of this, or is this just a matter of the budgeting wasn't managed right? I think for sure there is. It bears an investigation, so it will be interesting to see what comes of those.
Talking to Rob Menser from USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking at some of the top news of the week. Big political news came out. All the political nerds like us, Rob, are watching. crushing for the Marquette University Law School poll. They dropped some numbers on Wednesday. A tighter race for president than we'd seen.
Yeah, I feel like I need to speak about this because on this very program, Rob, the last couple of weeks I've been talking about how Wisconsin races don't look really all that close. And in this new poll, they look quite close, at least a large change from July's poll. So likely voters, Democrat Hillary Clinton is at 45%. Republican Donald Trump is at 42%. That is a three-point gap where it was 15 points a month ago.
Right. And we just had Gary Johnson, Libertarian Party candidate, speaking in Milwaukee, I believe, in the state last night. He polled at around 10%, either way you slice it. What do you make of the role of maybe third-party candidates in a race in Wisconsin where both candidates have high, both major party candidates have high unfavorable ratings?
Yeah, it's certainly an open question. So Johnson made his first campaign appearance. He was in Milwaukee yesterday, and he's breaking into double digits. He has 10% support for the Green Party. Jill Stein has 4% support among likely voters. What I found interesting about this, so it is true, and we hear a lot about it. If any year third parties are going to make a difference, maybe it's this year when both major party candidates are quite unpopular. But what I found interesting in this poll, at least, when the difference between when they asked just about the two major party candidates to when they asked about a four-person race, both Clinton and Trump went down by the same amount. So in the four-way race, Clinton's at 41%, Trump is at 38%. So that's still a three-point gap. So it might not be the case that there's a big impact there. Maybe Jill Stein gets a few Democrats, Gary Johnson gets a few Republicans.
Listeners can hear more about that in our archived interview with Charles Franklin from Wednesday. Rob, I want to move on to this story in Milwaukee. Police officers briefly detained, apparently, State Representative Jonathan Brostoff, a Milwaukee Democrat. What happened?
Yes, so this was on Tuesday evening. The police were out to disperse a protest in the Sherman Park neighborhood, site of course, the police shooting and the unrest and violence that followed. Representative Jonathan Brostoff was caught up in this, along with a youth organizer for the ACLU of Wisconsin. They were forced to the ground. They were handcuffed with zip ties, thrown into a police van, and detained for about 20 minutes. Before they were let go, which happened after police found out that Brostoff was an elected official. The Milwaukee Police Department said it's reviewing the incident. In a statement, they said that these men were not among the elected officials and community leaders who had previously made themselves known to the officer, causing confusion. But it's weird because I don't know what that has to do with it. Is there a law that you need to announce yourself if you're a public official? I don't quite understand that.
So we'll be watching for the results of that investigation. Rob, thanks as always for joining us today.
All right. Thanks a lot.
That's Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau, and he joins us every Friday at this time for a look at the top news stories from the last week.
It's our final installment of our summer music series, Setlist. Today we feature the Appleton band Dusk. They stopped by our studio to share some music and tell the story behind their country soul inspiration. Julie and Riley, thank you so much for coming into the studio and playing live for us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So from what I've read, it sounds like this band kind of came about as the result of a joke that someone used the phrase sweet country jams. And all of a sudden it became not a thing you eat, but a band. How did that happen?
Yeah, that was kind of a daydream that Amos and Colin and one of their other friends, Matt, had, where they thought of a record cover where they were like eating jam and had jam all over themselves, and it was a country record called Sweet Country Jams and pictures of jam in the background. Yeah, but Colin and Amos were kind of playing soul covers at the time, so I think it kind of sprung from that.
Riley, Charlie, how did you get on board with the new band?
I had shared an interest in country music with Amos and Colin, and kind of grew up on the old stuff like Patsy Cline and Hank, and there weren't very many other kids in town that were into that kind of stuff, and we all have our own home studios, so we just kind of like get together and write songs and record for fun, and eventually a band kind of came out of it. So,
and Julie, is that something that you share, that love of old-time country and soul?
Yeah, I love old country music, but I think what got me more, what we discovered we shared more of an interest in was the old soul music, because that's what I listen to all of the time, mostly.
Okay, so Riley, for you it was Patsy Cline. Who was it for you, Julia? Who did you love?
Well, I love Sam Cooke and Ann Peebles and Marvin Gaye and a bunch of other bands. It's hard to name them all.
So you're switching off lead vocals with Amos, and I understand you studied voice in college. So what does that bring to the band? What do you want to do with your voice here?
Yeah, I studied voice in college because I just always was obsessed with singing, and it taught me a lot of theory and how to talk about music and critically listen to music, I think. I use some of the way I studied voice in this band, but it's a very different approach because it's all, you know, close mic'd and using a different kind of expression versus classical music. So, but I do think about technique and stuff, I guess. Yeah.
I studied voice in college too, and it was not so easy to toggle between classical and anything else. You ended up sounding like John Denver trying to sing classical or vice versa. So how did you do it? How do you make that transition?
I had a really good teacher who, and I mean, I've always kind of just tried to sing how I feel about the song, like whatever the song's about. So I think not trying to fabricate anything is really important to me when I'm singing. So yeah, and I'm not worried about trying to fill a hall or sing over an orchestra, you know, so a lot of those kind of habits can fall away. But it is weird, for sure.
And you've got some sweet low notes that are coming out in the mix. Is that where your voice feels happy, singing those low, belty notes?
Yeah, I was a contralto in school. I've always had a low voice. She could stay the night, make you
what you brought. I think you're the first person on set list to be playing the instrument you're playing.
It's a six-string pedal steel. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about how you got started playing that.
Well, initially when we were all getting together and writing songs and recording, I was just playing guitar and kind of adding that to the group. And Amos had a pedal steel sitting around, and they recorded with that for the single Too Sweet, and I was just like, if you want me to play pedal steel, I'll learn it. And
that's funny, because I was going to say, it seems like a really intentional instrument, that if you're going to play pedal steel, you set out having that fire burning in your heart to play pedal steel, but it sounds like you came to it
I've always just,
later.
I've loved the sound and like the feel of the instrument, and just try and emulate that from the old records I used to listen to.
So this instrument was not your first love. What was?
No, I play drums mostly, and that's what I grew up playing, and then started writing songs on guitar, and from there I did a lot of like solo recording where I'd play all the parts. So yeah, I kind of dabble in most of it, but drums is my main focus.
Thank you. the band is from Appleton. What is it like making music in Appleton? I mean, now we hear so much all the time about Eau Claire being the new music hub in Wisconsin. What does Appleton have going for it? Or not have going for it? What do you think?
It's pretty tight-knit. It's a small community. But there are different sects of people working on music. There's a pretty supportive group, though. You know, it's a small town, so you kind of all do stuff together or at least know what other people are up to.
Yeah, there's quite a strong DIY underground scene, and then the Mile of Music has really brought kind of a new side to the music scene too, and we're starting to get in touch with some of those bands and bring the community a little closer. And I mean, I grew up in Appleton, and it's always been like a pretty strong music scene, so living there my whole life, I've kind of met most of the musicians because it's a pretty small town. And
I read an interview with the band, I can't remember which one of you said it, but one of you said that it was not a great town for gigging. Is that still true, or is it changing?
Yeah, it's nice to leave. There are a lot of like cover bands that play downtown. There's not really a lot of venues for original music, but that's starting to grow more with Mile Music coming in and kind of like showing these potential venues that you can have original music and like people will come out and support that.
Been curious about here on Setlist is we speak with a lot of regional musicians. Some of them make the big time and they're touring. A lot of them, you know, they're more local. So how does music fit into your life right now? Is it something that is the main focus of what you're doing, or is this what you do on the side?
Oh, for every member, I think it's the kind of forefront of what they're thinking about all the time. And I don't ever since I can remember, I just always was like, oh, I want to be in choir and orchestra and whatever and take lessons and stuff. So, and then my parents are like the most supportive parents. So they just were like, okay, well, we'll do it then. And it just has always been a fixture. And for a while I got into farming and I stopped playing music, and then I was just kind of really unsatisfied. So I switched back.
Really? You got into farming? And you left music and got into farming and then you came back?
Yeah. I was tomato farming and I had hives, beehives and stuff like that. And I really didn't play music at all. And then I was just kind of like, I don't know, I just felt like kind of like something was missing. So I still garden and stuff, but I play music a lot.
Is that one of those only in Wisconsin things, you think, that someone could leave, keep bees, grow tomatoes, and then come back and be in a soul country band?
I'm sure there's other rural areas that kind of thing happens, but Wisconsin is one of those places for sure.
So going forward, I know that it's a group that draws from other groups, and you have different members who come in and out to play different pieces in your songs. But how does it work as a collaborative? How do you produce stuff, and where are you going next?
We all write. Every one of us has written songs for the group, so we just bring one and or record a demo and send it to everybody, and everybody records. Amos is probably the main recording guy. We have a studio in our basement. Yeah, very collaborative. We all try and support each other.
Here comes the light. It comes out at night. Here comes the light. There's a beacon calling for.
Here comes the light.
Where the bored recluse will howl at the moon all night.
Are you all roommates?
Amos and Colin and I live together. And then Riley lives close by. And Tyler lives in Madison here.
You make it sound like kind of a family. Does it feel like that?
Yeah, I think any band feels family vibes for after they spend so much time together, you know, and you're trying to be creative together, so you reveal some of yourself when you're doing that.
Sounds like kind of a creative crucible. You can just roll out of bed, someone's got a song idea, you hit the studio. Does it work like that?
I mean, yeah, that sometimes it is that romantic, and sometimes it's, you know, a little less romantic, but pretty much. I mean, we're all around all the time, so we hear what we're listening to, or if someone's in their room with their guitar amp up loud.
Guys, gonna do any touring coming up?
This September we'll be hitting the East Coast and a little bit of Canada for a couple weeks.
So I know there's different tiers of touring, and you know there's the paid for all the way with a sweet coach, and then there's somebody's van. What is your tour gonna be like?
It's a lot of stuff in a van.
Yeah, a lot of people, a lot of gear.
Little you looking space. Forward to it?
Yes.
Oh yeah, it'll be great.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
Sounds like fun. You're giving me band envy.
Oh, good.
All right, you guys, thank you so much for coming and playing in the studio today.
Thanks for
Yeah, thank you.
That was the Appleton band Dusk. Support for Setlist comes from Hyde Music. For more about the artists featured on Setlist, including songs and videos of their exclusive performances at our WPR studio, head over to wpr.org/setlist.
That wraps up this year's Setlist Summer Music Series, but the Setlist website will be continually updated with new content. Just head over to wpr.org/setlist to discover your new favorite band.
Coming up, a look at how Milwaukee has successfully balanced industry and quality of life in the Menominee Valley. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. Tonight, it was one of the closest and most contentious elections of our lifetime, and then the Supreme Court stepped in. Remembering the Bush v. Gore decision this week on Ken Rudin's Political Junkie, tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, there was a time not all that long ago that Milwaukee's position as a manufacturing stronghold had declined and the loss of industry was taking its toll on the city.
But as our next guest outlines, in the past 30 years, a combination of planning, investment, and inspiration have led to a successful revitalization centered in the city's Menominee Valley.
Colin Woodard joins us now. He's a Politico magazine contributing editor, where he wrote the recent piece, How Milwaukee Shook Off the Rust. He's also author of the book, American Character, A History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good. Colin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Now, you focus in your piece on the Menominee Valley area of Milwaukee, and as you describe it, I mean, this sounds like it could have been the poster child for the phrase Rust Belt. Can you describe it at, I guess, the low point?
Yes. I mean, many of your listeners probably remember it firsthand, but what was described to me is, you know, you come in to the city from, you know, Chicago or from the west, and you're on those overpasses and viaducts or at the interstate, and the great thing greeting you at the gate was this deteriorated and largely derelict industrial zone that had become the repository for everything the rest of the city didn't want, be it scrap yards and junk piles and polluting industries, and this enormous former rail yard complex, the Milwaukee Roads Complex, all lying by the late 1980s, derelict over an enormous, many, many tens of acres, and absolutely falling apart. And this was what greeted everybody, and was not considered the best advertisement for Milwaukee. It certainly seemed to say Rust Belt to people.
That's the before picture. Let's talk about the after picture, and then we'll spend most of our time thinking about how we connect the dots between the two. But how would you describe it today?
Well, it's remarkable. What drew my attention was that a lot of cities are abandoning their industrial zones, trying to attract different purposes and tenants to them. Here's a place that's been transformed into sort of a model for what a 21st century industrial zone might look like in a city. It's sort of a kind of an eco-industrial park, you might say. They used, design standards. It combines recreational uses and the Hank Aaron Trail and wetlands and stormwater drainage parks and wildlife with manufacturing and all of the things that light manufacturing needs. So it's sort of a investing in sort of the future of manufacturing in a way that few cities have been doing in the United States of late.
Now let's talk about why that is. As you say, a common alternative for a blighted former industrial area like that might be to ignore it as much as possible, or maybe we can convert it into some trendy residential rehabbed factories. What happened in this part of Milwaukee, this Menominee Valley area, that set it off on this different, maybe unique path?
Well, there were several strands of things that were coming together and happening in the late 1980s and early 1990s that sort of came together at the right moment, the right synergies to make this all happen. One was, in short, that the Brewers and Bud Selig were looking for a new stadium and ended up planting it at the upper end of the Menominee Valley. And when they did that, it had the accidental effect of suddenly increasing the speculative value of that enormous old abandoned railway yard I described, the Milwaukee Road Complex, which had just been sitting there. And there became, therefore, suddenly it was pushed onto everybody's agenda, what should become of this place? Because the land management company that held control of it wanted to make it into an entertainment district. You know, people would finish the game and, or, you know, before the game, go over there to restaurants and bars and all that. And it became the question, is that what we should really be doing with this? At the same time, the 16th Street Health Clinic, a wide-minded community health clinic, was also dealing with various contamination issues and other issues in the near south side. And that had drawn their attention, as their then director had been looking sort of broadly at what affected the health of clients. They were realizing that a lot of people in that area needed a safe place to play and, you know, recreate and indeed work and have less pollution and contamination. And you had this enormous sort of forgotten industrial zone right next to there. So that was drawing their attention. And what they brought to the table was some planning around what should this place look like. They ended up convening lots of architects from around the city to sort of brainstorm on what this place might look like instead, but with sort of human health and environmental ideas in the mix. And the third component was that you had, at the time, Mayor John Norquist was your mayor, who later went on to be the head of the Congress of New Urbanism and was sort of a new urbanist city planner thinker in his own right. And with all of this mix of things in front of him, he brought the city administration to try to actually draw up plans and ideas as to what would be the best use for this with all this going on. And the result of all that was people had this vision for this sort of, you know, eco-industrial park that would be attractive to industries elsewhere in Milwaukee, elsewhere in the country, and maybe around the world, while also bringing in recreational values and making it a place that people could actually use for other purposes, a sort of rethink of things. So it's those three unlikely things coming together all at once over a, you know, pretty long 10-15-year time period, which is often the kind of time periods it takes for some of these big changes in cities.
Talking to Colin Woodard from Politico Magazine, talking about his piece, How Milwaukee Shook Off the Rust, talking about the Menominee Valley part of Milwaukee and how it turned, he says, from rust belt into modern eco-industrial landscape where people actually can live and recreate too. And Colin, I think probably a lot of people are looking at your piece for lessons. Is this something we can do elsewhere, you know, in Milwaukee, in cities in Wisconsin, in cities around the Midwest? Sounds like one lesson. You just mentioned a few players. You also write about a tribal group being involved. It seems like a lesson is a lot of people really have to be at the table. This isn't something that can be done by a mayor or an entrepreneur or just one group or person planning this.
Correct. I mean, this series that this article is part of is called the What Works series, which is looking at successful things that are happening in cities all over the place. Sometimes they're dealing with transportation, sometimes with revitalizing a downtown, and of course, in this situation, with sort of the reindustrialization of a zone. But what seems to be a common denominator, even though, you know, what ended up being some of the criteria that made each of these things work, what I've discovered while traveling around the country writing these is that often there's this ethos of cooperation that comes together somehow, and it almost always involves some variety of what people call a public-private partnership, where you get the, you know, city and public entities and nonprofits and the corporate and business sector all coming together to try to do something that furthers the interests of the whole community. And it's in those moments, and the vehicles take very different shapes in different cities, but that is almost always a common theme you see behind these sort of big successful projects. And I'm glad you mentioned the tribe, the Potawatomi. That was another fortunate thing that happened at the same time. They were coming around the late 80s and early 90s wanting to build a bingo hall that eventually became their casino. But and they were, you know, like many things, whatever you didn't want elsewhere in the city was often sent to the valley. So they found themselves in the valley, but they were highly successful and, you know, civic-minded and wanted to invest and help this change happen in their you know, return to their old neighborhood from the, you know, 1700s. And so they ended up investing and being players as well. So that was another important strand in your case.
Talking to Politico magazine contributing editor Colin Woodard about his recent piece, How Milwaukee Shook Off the Rust.
And we want to hear from you on this. What signs do you see of Milwaukee's manufacturing renaissance, and how well the city is balancing that change with cultural and environmental concerns? If you've been a longtime Milwaukee resident, what changes have you seen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we're continuing our conversation with Politico magazine contributing editor Colin Woodard about his recent article, How Milwaukee Shook Off the Rust.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see signs that Milwaukee's manufacturing strength is returning? Do you think that's a good direction for the city to be going in? Are you involved in this Menominee Valley success story, as our guest describes it? Do you live near there? Do you work there? Do you have a business there? Call in now, 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Colin, I think maybe sometimes people might think Milwaukee and success story and think, well, but I keep hearing bad news. Like, there are all these bad headlines of violence, urban problems. Do we overlook the success stories in cities like Milwaukee?
Well, I think success stories often get overlooked, especially out in the away from the centers of national media, where, you know, there people from the outside aren't looking as often, and maybe when you're living, you know, in the middle of it all, sometimes these things aren't recognized as well. You know, these things happen slowly over a long period of time, and sort of as you're living among it, sometimes it's not seen. You have to sort of take a step back to kind of realize some of the things that have happened. And certainly Milwaukee, you know, has its problems, and recent events, have shown that, and it's been in the news for not good reasons. But this is something really interesting if you're, you know, looking around the country at things that are happening in cities. This is a really interesting and fresh development. And indeed, the city is trying to replicate the model from the Menominee Valley, first in the Harbor District area, where there's a sort of nonprofit in an earlier phase trying to envision and think about what that area might look like as a working port that would have some of these other values in it, and also in an earlier phase of things up the 30th Street corridor.
Let's go to our callers now. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. You mentioned your comments about the Brewer Stadium kind of starting to revitalize some of the valley there. I was wondering if you could speak to any parallels you might see between that and the Buck Stadium that's going to be happening in the next couple of years here.
Marcus, thanks for the call. I don't know, Colin, if you're following the new basketball stadium in Milwaukee, but do you have general lessons about a good way to leverage a sports facility here?
Yeah, I have not been following the Buck Stadium story from afar, but in general, as I've traveled around the country, often sports stadiums show up and in the story of the city, and I'd have to say that more often than not, it's sort of a story of, you know, a wasted opportunity in terms of how to do economic development. You know, I won't pick out any specific examples, but oftentimes, you know, cities only have so much money to spend and direct towards efforts to do something new and revitalize things, or partner with the private sector to do something that would be catalytic. And these stadiums cost a lot of money, and often the public basically puts all its money in this one basket, and the return on that investment is often not as large as some of these other partnerships and things you see that are a little more complicated, that it require more time, that have more moving parts. And I guess the lesson I've seen there is that a lot of stadiums were built in, say, the 1990s and early 2000s, and that was going to be the great silver bullet. And it often hasn't been. So that's the general lesson I'd give. I know nothing about the specifics, though, with the Buck Stadium.
Marcus, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Melanie from Wauwatosa. Melanie, hi.
Hi. So...
Go ahead, Melanie.
I worked on the Menominee River Valley, and it's... I've been working there for about 4 years, and I just wanted to say they really do a lot to try to include us as workers in the factories, you know, sending out emails, asking people for suggestions and remarks, and having classes at the community center down there, at the Eco Center for cooking, and getting people involved in the Hank Aaron 5K and everything like that. And even lately, we've been having food trucks, so we've introduced those down into the area in the past couple of months. So it really is a community, and all the businesses seem to interact together really well to make things happen and bring cool new things to the area.
Melanie, thanks a lot for sharing your experience there. And Colin, that isn't something you usually think of, industrial development and community engagement with the workers and all these available things to do.
Right, exactly. It's sort of like the model. You know, you see this kind of model and structure and sort of cultural attitude in a lot of the new high-tech industries, you know, the Google campuses and the, you know, the cool startups, that form in different places, be it, you know, around 128 in Boston or satellites in Manchester, New Hampshire, or wherever it is. But a lot of those lessons about, how to do a work and maybe even a work play, and in some places work play live environment, I think are starting to be applied in very different contexts. And now in this case, you're starting to see it in an industrial context. I mean, nobody lives in the Menominee Valley, so you're missing, you know, the final sort of stage and component of it. But people are realizing that, you know, you can create spaces that there's no reason that industrial zones have to be, you know, these awful places to work, because, you know, it's nice to be able to walk out of your industrial job and have trails and places to eat your lunch and all that too. And people are starting to realize with a lot of industries, there's absolutely no reason you can't do that. And it actually makes you attractive to businesses, at home and afar.
Time for one more quick call. Thanks, Melanie. We've got Steve in Lake Mills. Steve, hi.
Yeah, hi there. I think that in order to move forward with the progress that we've seen in Milwaukee, we still need to really tackle the problem of income inequality. And I think that a good way to do that is to teach people how to start cooperative businesses, as well as incentivize current businesses to switch to a more cooperative model. One manufacturing plant in Milwaukee just did this recently. And I think it's also important to incentivize people who are entrepreneurs who are starting businesses to start their businesses in the impoverished areas of Milwaukee.
Steve, I want to jump in because we're just about out of time, and I want to get Colin to answer that. So leveraging the success here to help new entrepreneurs, new businesses, especially in impoverished areas, Colin.
It sounds like a good idea. This article wasn't focusing on income inequality, but it's obviously an issue that's enormously important, not only for Milwaukee, but for the country at large. And, finding ways to bridge that and new ideas for that is certainly a top priority thing in public policy in this country.
And as we wrap up, Colin, are people around the country watching this development in Milwaukee trying to learn lessons from it?
I hope so now. that's the hope, is that people are drawn their attention to the article and to the series, and it gives food for thought for people in other cities with similar challenges and perhaps opportunities.
Colin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Colin Woodard is a writer for Politico magazine. He's a contributing editor there. He joined us to talk about his recent article, How Milwaukee Shook Off the Rust, talking about redevelopment, industrial development in the once Rust Belt Menominee Valley area. You can read his piece, by the way, and share your comments, thoughts, and suggestions over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Thank you.
Gary Johnson is promoting economic conservatism and social liberalism as he campaigns for the White House. Chuck Kornbach prepared this report on the Libertarian presidential candidate's speech in Milwaukee last night.
The OJs singing Give the People What They Want played in the background at Milwaukee's Serb Hall, fitting perhaps for an audience that wants an alternative to Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. Standing near the back of the room, Greg Walensky says he voted for Republican Mitt Romney 4 years ago, but he's not a Trump supporter.
I don't believe he's fit to lead our country. He may not be bought out by special interests already like Hillary is, but I don't think he has a real viewpoint on things.
Walensky says he's backing libertarian Gary Johnson in part because the former Republican governor of New Mexico promises to decriminalize marijuana and allow stores to sell it.
I think that'd be great for our tax base and less people in prison, less police, and be centered on that, be able to focus on more actual things to take care of than drug issues.
Two friends, Matthew Joseph and Jamie Collins, seem less interested in Johnson's liberal social views and more in his conservative fiscal policies. Joseph says he likes Johnson's record in New Mexico.
Just the way he was able to drop the spending. I mean, most of this is Google, right? But reading his page, just his policy on vetoing things unless they were like strictly necessary, leading to large savings. I feel like we could use more of that.
Collins, who's a 23-year-old college student, says financial decisions now will affect her future.
Whatever happens in this election, my generation is going to be the one who has to deal with it. So I'm looking for small government. I like the fact that he doesn't want government involved in things that it doesn't really need to be.
The crowd's enthusiasm for Johnson erupted when he was brought to the stage.
It's my pleasure to introduce to you the man that the New Yorker magazine called the Libertarian's secret weapon, Governor Gary Johnson.
Johnson seemed to give his supporters what they wanted to hear, promising to get rid of the income and corporate tax while reducing military intervention overseas, decriminalizing marijuana, and supporting immigration. He calls his political philosophy a six-lane highway.
And the big six-lane highway down the middle is reflective of what most people in this country believe. Fiscally conservative, small government, socially inclusive.
Voter polls say so far most people are not on Johnson's road. He's doing better than libertarians traditionally have in national contests, but the Marquette survey has Johnson at 11% in Wisconsin, and he's a bit lower than that in national data. Johnson told reporters he thinks he can get to the 15% national polling number that would allow him to be in the presidential candidate debates, and he says that's vital.
Without being on the debate stage, there's no way that you can win the presidency. It's estimated that the viewership for the first presidential debate is going to exceed that of the Super Bowl. You can't win the Super Bowl if you're not in it.
For longtime libertarian Robert Gordon, who drove down from Green Bay to Milwaukee to listen to Johnson, seeing him in at least the debates would be a plus.
I hope so. He deserves to be heard, if nothing else.
Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.